Hey guys, I am Caleb Giddings from Taurus USA, and you are watching or listening to another episode of Gunday Brunch brought to you by Taurus USA and guns.com. At Taurus USA, we make affordable and reliable firearms, and at guns.com, you can buy them, as well as consume a lot of really good content around firearms education and a lot of other fun stuff. And speaking of good content, you'll notice we don't have Keith with us today. Instead, my guest is Professor David. You know what? I just realized I don't know how to say your last name. Is it Yamane
Yamani.
or it's Yamane? Okay. So in my head, I was saying it right. So I could say it like a Yankee and be like, oh, we got a David Yamane out here. But no, we have my friend and Wake Forest professor David Yamane. So David, why don't you tell the people a little bit about your background, what you do, and just a little bit of how you, and we'll talk about the book, I promise, but kind of how you got to where you are.
As you said, I'm a professor of sociology at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, not to be confused with the Lake Forest University, which is outside of Chicago. Grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I think probably the most atypical thing about myself, because I am just a sort of typical liberal professor in a lot of ways, is that for 42 years of my life, I was completely outside of guns and gun culture, never saw, touched, or fired a gun. And then from age 42 to now, which is another 13 years, I've been sort of deeply involved in being a gun owner, trying to mature as a gun owner, and also studying guns and gun culture professionally as a sociologist. So I think that's probably why I'm here.
Fair enough. So for, to kind of continue that, talk to me about the book. Like, obviously, it represents the culmination of a lot of work that you've put into this space, but what is it, kind of give me a run through of that, of the work, of the goal of the book, and kind of what it's about for people who don't know.
Well, as you know, when I started the journey, I was getting interested in guns, in my individual life, and I became a gun owner, and I guess I said tried to become a better gun owner over time. But I also was doing this research. I began thinking I was just going to do a very simple, discrete study of why do people carry concealed handguns. But as I started investigating that, started trying to understand what other people had said about that, I realized that that was just part of a much bigger thing, which I took to calling gun culture 2.0, stealing a phrase from Michael Bayne. And so it just kept getting bigger and bigger. But I still, was thinking I'm just going to write an academic book that's going to be published by a university press and read by, 50 people and go into 200 university libraries. Which is what I've done my whole career. I've published many books before that in the sociology of religion. But at some point I realized, well, I actually maybe have a story to tell that would be of more general interest, that really put my own story kind of front and center, and then brought in my sociological observations to supplement my story rather than sort of vice versa, which would be more academically common. So the book really then, represents everything I understand, not everything, a lot of what I understand about guns as a sociologist, but really tells this my that understanding from my individual first person perspective. So it really is my journey into American gun culture.
Awesome. I've got a bunch of things that I want to ask you about that, and I'm going to do them in no particular order, basically the order that came to my head. You mentioned gun culture 2.0, and that's a phrase that we've been using for, some time now, to the point that I wonder, do you think that we have actually moved past that into almost a 3.0 or 2.5, or to kind of torture that metaphor a little bit, but like the next iteration of what American gun culture looks like?
Well, let me preface my comment by saying that one of the downsides of using this is I think of it as being kind of a heuristic device, a conceptual heuristic device to help us organize what's really just a completely messy and complex reality. But it simplifies that reality in the sense that we can say, hey, guns have always been a part of the American experience. Gun culture per se kind of emerges in the 19th century, where we see people starting to engage in organized activities around, hunting and recreational shooting, and maybe a little bit later, sort of mass collecting what we would call kind of gun culture 1.0 activities, but then, you know, decisively shifting, you know, beginning in the 60s, but, you know, in the decades following, to a self-defense orientation, right? And again, that self-defense orientation was always part of guns and gun culture, but it really becomes the center of gun culture at some point, I'd say around 2010. So that's the basic idea of this shift from gun culture 1.0 to 2.0. But it doesn't say, you know, people recreationally shoot still, people still hunt, people collect, you know, there's all of this stuff happening. So I don't, you know, I think sometimes people misunderstand. We say, well, you know, I do a lot of things with my guns. So that's a preface to answering your question, which is that I don't really know where gun culture is going, because I have a hard enough time just understanding what's happening yesterday and today, and I have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow. But, you know, I think that for there to be a true gun culture 3.0, there would have to emerge something that then becomes the central thing that people do with guns. And I think a more likely sort of development is that there's going to be more of a kind of fragmentation or maybe a differentiation. So, you know, there'll be your defensive gun owners, there'll be your tactical defensive gun owners, there'll be your precision rifle shooters, there'll be your sport shooters, your hunters, with some overlap, but maybe not complete overlap, and possibly even a dimension of gun culture where people aren't even necessarily gun users, but they just believe in guns as part of their rights, and then it becomes tied into more of a political project. So if I had to guess, if there was to be a gun culture 3.0, it would be around the politics of guns.
So, or, you know, if I wanted to make, I don't know if it'd be a controversial statement, but if I wanted to say something that could be, you know, easily clipped into a soundbite for reels later, which is exactly what I'm doing, you could almost take from that the defining characteristic of a gun culture 3.0, if such a thing were to exist, would be its fractured nature, in that the absolute massive presence of the internet and everyone's easy ability to find other people who like the exact same thing as them, right? Like, because I remember, you know, in the early days that I was getting started, you had to, as someone who is, you know, very focused on competition shooting, I had to go look for other competition shooters. I had to go out and find them. And there was a little bit of work involved in that. And now, you know, if you are someone who only shoots, you know, 6.5 Creedmoor in PRS rifle competitions, and that's all you care about, you can find 100 other people who that's also all they care about.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, maybe that we don't really have a, you know, a core gun culture going forward, and we just have a bunch of lifestyle enclaves. So I think there's definitely something to that. And I will also try to reduce my responses to YouTube shorts length from my typical New Yorker long form essay.
That's what I have, you know, that's what we edit these things for. So, you know, it's important that, but, you know, it is funny. Like, I think also the fractured attention span is definitely a thing that affects, you know, there's lots of smart people talking about it. I'm not one of those people, but, you know, it's affected gun culture and the perception of it as well, where we have gone in a transition from how information is disseminated through, you know, gun culture 2.0. It was blogs and forums and a lot of like long format YouTube videos, which, by the way, the YouTube definition of a long format video is anything over 12 minutes long. That's long. That's a long format video. But, you know, and now you see a lot of Instagram content, reels, very short form content with people trying to bang as much information as possible or no information whatsoever into 30, 60, 90 seconds. And I think there's a lot of change that's happened just in my time in the firearms industry that it gives me a little bit of whiplash from time to time. So I can't imagine what it must look like to an outsider who, you know, this isn't, because the gun industry is not your job. You're a teacher at a college. That's your actual job.
Yeah. And I think about how curated my view of gun culture actually is, because there's a ton of content out there that I just really don't pay any attention to. And maybe when I was first starting, that made more sense. You know, like, there's nothing in my book about Instagram influencers. You know, I don't write about, you know, people wearing nods and, you know, this kind of thing. And they know that's a reality of gun culture out there, just not been a part of, you know, the reality that I've been examining closely. And so, you know, there's a bit of a division of labor. Like I'll look at what I can look at and let somebody else look at something else. But, you know, there, I think, you know, back to the 2.0 idea, people were talking about gun culture 3.0, and I was like, it's not a reality until I publish my Gun Culture 2.0 book, and then you guys can talk about whatever you want after
Perfect. All right. You heard it here first, guys. We got to
that.
wait until the book is out. Then we can start talking about the transition to gun culture 3.0. I'm here for it. I love it.
Yeah.
The other thing that I wanted to bring up is, you know, you talked about your entry into firearms enthusiasm into this space. And I know that there's a kind of a common thread that we have there because part of that vector for you was Top Shot, right?
You know, it's funny because you know, for a lot of people, this is just some dumb TV show that ran for a few years on the History Channel, or you know, even if you liked it,
Five
you
to be
didn't.
exact.
Five is does that include the All-Star season?
I do can yeah, absolutely. That
Yeah,
includes yeah, five you had 5 seasons of the show.
yeah. So yeah, you know, and it's easy just to think, oh, that's just entertainment or whatever. But I re distinctively remember the first time I ever saw Top Shot. I was sitting in a hotel room in Georgia with my son, who was at a tennis tournament, and it was a rain delay. And I just started flipping through the channels. I didn't have cable at home at the time. And so I was like, what's on cable TV these days? And I saw Colby Donaldson, who I recognized from having watched Survivor one season. And I stopped like, what's Colby Donaldson doing? And then I was introduced to this whole world of firearms that I knew absolutely nothing about. And you know, not just people killing themselves or somebody else or hurting someone, but I remember the trick shot showdown in season one, shooting over the shoulder, Annie Oakley style, Chris Sereno driving nails with a rickety 19th century revolver. And I didn't just go like, now I have to get guns, but it planted a seed in me of understanding like, whoa, you know, that was pretty cool. These people are really good at doing that. And it sort of highlighted what I would come to call the normality of guns and gun owners. And that really came to be an important moment in my life.
Yeah, it's funny because I think, you know, I would say that I have a complicated relationship with Top Shot, although not nearly as much as it used to be. I've been told by many people that Top Shot was their gateway drug for either their entrance into, you know, firearms enthusiasm or someone that they cared about, where, you know, you had a lot of instances where you would have a parent or a partner in a relationship be like, hey, let's watch this thing together. It's basically Survivor with guns. And they would watch, and you know, the other person watching be like, oh, I guess guns are for more than just my perception of the guns that has been, you know, permeated by mass media, or permeated, that was the wrong word, perpetuated by mass media.
Yeah. And again, I think that this is something that when I look at mainstream television today, there really isn't anything on that represents that aspect of guns and gun culture. And I don't know all the reasons why Top Shot was taken off the air. Maybe it didn't get pulled the ratings it needed to. Maybe there was some discomfort with the portrayal of guns. Maybe you know something more about that than I do.
I have there is some Top Shot tea. So Top Shot got very good ratings, especially for its time slot. And what killed Top Shot was a change in leadership at History Channel. It was bought by, I want to say it was the AMC, one of the, so because that was back in the in 2014, 15-ish when a lot of the cable channels were getting bought by big conglomerates, and you know, all of a sudden Travel Channel and Food Network and all these other channels were now owned by one big company. And that happened to History Channel, and one of their edicts was basically no more gun shows, which so Top Shot went away. The absolutely wonderful Mail Call with Arlie Ermey went away as a result of that as well. And that was one of my favorite shows because Arlie Ermey was such a, like, it was very silly entertainment stuff, but he was such a fun character to watch because you sort of realized that he was always playing Arlie Ermey no matter what. Yeah, so that was what killed Top Shot. And I think, and it was also a very unique product of its time. You couldn't do Top Shot today in a way that would still be meaningful because of all of the media that's out there now. And also, I don't think you could get it, you know, and believe me, they've tried. A lot of the outdoor networks, you know, your Sportsman's and Outdoor Channels have tried to kind of do their own spin on Top Shot, and it never works quite as well. And I think the reason for that is what made Top Shot work well was that the contestants knew a lot about shooting guns, and the producers and the studio knew a lot about making good TV. And when you have that balance, you get a product that is, I mean, if you go to, I think they're on History Channel still, but if people are listening to this and you never watched them and they're still out there on History or whatever, go watch them. They're a phenomenally watchable product, even 14 years later. The product, yeah, the end product is good and it's entertaining and it's watchable. But enough about...
We're done with Top Shot. I was just gonna say I can imagine a situation like I used to watch Hell's Kitchen with Gordon Ramsay. Mm-hmm. And you know, early on it was like a new format. It was a standard kind of survivor type thing, but in a kitchen. But after, you know, a certain number of seasons, then they start doing stupid things, you know, like creating certain types of teams, or they started getting home cooks. And so I can imagine, you know, seasons 20 of Top Shot. What are they going to do? They're just going to go pick random people off the street, or, you know, professors versus strippers, or, you know, some sort of crazy setup like that.
A girl I dated for a while was really into The Apprentice. And so I probably watched like 8 seasons of that show. And that's exactly what they did. I very distinctly remember a season of The Apprentice where it was people with college degrees versus people without college degrees. That was like the whole premise of the show, was like hard work versus higher education. And it was so freaking dumb. I'm like, none of these are actual, you know, objective measures of how good these people will be at doing whatever silly thing Donald Trump wants them to do this week. Because it's not like, you know, you were asking like a Cornell graduate to, you know, they would be like, all right, who's going to figure out the most efficient way to sweep these 10 floors? Like, but anyway, now we are done talking about reality TV, guys, I promise. So let's get back to the book. You know, obviously I don't want you to give away all of the contents, but what was it? Was your goal always to write a book, or was this something that sort of like, well, was this book itself the goal, or did you kind of not know? You were like, I'm going to write a book about the gun culture, or about my journey through the gun culture, but you kind of didn't know what it was going to look like.
Yeah, well, you know, again, in the initial version, it was the title was Gun Culture 2.0, and I sort of marched through, you know, the history, the law, technology, training, insurance, like just all these aspects of defensive gun culture. And then when I shifted more towards, you know, telling my story, then I started to think about what would be, and this is not easy to think about, what's going to be a book that's going to appeal to people who are, or like lifelong gun owners, you know, who you can't tell them anything about gun already know. Also gun skeptics, you know, people who come from outside gun culture, don't understand why guns make sense to people who own them and why guns are only terrible. And then also these people in the middle, the gun curious, right? They're not bought in one way or the other. And so really the trick was to figure out what voice could I bring to bring in all of those people. So, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about, it's not a pure chronological narrative, but it does kind of start with, here's how I became a gun owner, right? Here's how I realized the normality of gun ownership. Here's how I accumulated 13 guns. You know, here's my thoughts on AR-15s, and then sort of from there. So it does kind of sort of use the idea of me maturing as a gun owner, sort of as the guiding kind of narrative. And so people who, and probably the people who have read the book the most are people who are totally bought into guns. You know, people I've met through the gun training industry, which I didn't really expect, because I thought those people would be like, you can't tell me nothing I don't already know about guns. That's me mimicking people live around me here in Mocksville, North Carolina. But
They're my neighbors too in South Carolina,
yeah, no,
so.
it's like my barber, and he loved the book, and I was like, you've been a gun owner your whole life, you hunt, you have, defensive gun owner, what do I have to say to you? But they like hearing this story of someone who doesn't come from that background, who nonetheless kind of ends up in the same place they do and brings a different sort of perspective to it. The go ahead.
I think I think there is an intellectual attraction to the concept of someone that you would view as an outsider embracing your values, right? And I use the term values very broadly there, but the idea that a pardon the phrase, a liberal professor from San Francisco who teaches at Wake Forest suddenly becoming a gun owner is a narrative that people who are, more traditional gun owners, lifelong gun owners, or even political activists would look at and say, "Hey, this is interesting. I want to read about this journey." Which I mean, that's my interest in it as well. And for me, my interest in the book extends beyond that because my wife is actually in the target demographic that you wrote the book for originally. She grew up in New York. She's never owned a gun in her entire life. We are a gun owning household, but they're not her guns or anything like that. So for me, there's that attraction to the book as well, to be like, here, don't listen, just read this. This person has way more in common with your background than with my background, because I have a very traditional gun owner background. My dad was a cop. I grew up shooting. I had a got a BB gun when I was 12, a rifle when I was 16. For my 21st birthday, I got a handgun. So like, I have like a gun owner background. But so we've got the book, we have that product, and you mentioned people in the training community, and I think that's where, and I forget who it was, but I'm gonna say Sarah Hopman because she's been such a vector for many wonderful things in my life. But I think it was her that made me aware of you the first time, but I could be wrong about that because it's been a really long time at this point. But talk about some of that high level training that you've done. What was your why would you if you were someone who didn't know anything about guns, why not just take like the basics and stop there? You've taken some very advanced classes from some very res well respected national trainers.
But again, beginning with this idea, I'm just going to study concealed carry, and then I realize there's this bigger sort of defensive gun culture out there. One of the first things I notice about that gun culture 2.0 is that there's this huge training community, or huger than I thought. I mean, it's very modest on industry scale, just as guns are modest on the industry scale. I was surprised to know that there were so many different courses being offered, weekend long, week long courses. And so I thought, I have to know more about this. I got a small seed grant from Wake Forest, and one of the things I used that money to do was to go to Phoenix and take Mag 40 with Massad Ayoub, because people were talking a lot about, Mas. This is in 2012. I think from that, I sort of got connected into all sorts of other people who are part of the gun training community. I end up going to the Rangemaster Tactical Conference when it was still held in Memphis. And, from there you start meeting more people. And so I cumulatively probably observed and or taken several hundred hours of gun training classes, largely focused on defensive firearms. And really, I conclude the book, well, not with the actual conclusion, but the last chapter of the book is called Becoming Responsibly Armed. And it talks about how, I went on this kind of journey into gun training, and really the lessons I learned in the process, about mindset, about having options other than just shooting people. It's unfortunate because I could have written eight chapters just about gun training. I had to squeeze it all down into one, but I do try to hit a lot of the highlights about, what I learned, beginning with, concealed carry and some of the important things that I learned even in a concealed carry class.
Let's talk about concealed carry for a minute. You talk about how defensive, the driving factor for a lot of what we're calling gun culture 2.0 is the defensive use of firearms, right? People, as I say, people, the most American thing that you can do when you don't like the shape of the world around you is to buy a gun, right? And we saw a lot of that during COVID and the, following civil unrest. But all of those, not all, but the vast majority of those guns that were bought during COVID were bought with the intent of personal protection. And whether they were ever even loaded or fired is not, that's a completely different conversation. But when you talk about that idea of owning a gun for personal protection as being the motivating factor, what has your exposure been to people's deeper motivations behind personal protection, right? Like, have people had sort of watershed moments where they're like, oh, I need a gun, or is it something that they grew up with? Like, kind of how have you been exposed to people's deeper motivations?
Yeah. Well, here I think there's a range of motivations, all the way from just, for example, in my case, in addition to watching Top Shot, I had a very uncomfortable interaction with one of my apartment neighbors and her boyfriend slash drug dealer in the parking lot of our apartment
Those are
complex.
great.
Yeah. And for me, that was really the first time I made, direct eye contact with another person who I realized would very easily do violence to me. I had my kids with me. And again, I didn't drive, like from the parking lot out to the Gander Mountain Gun Superstore and load up, but it planted a seed of like, hey, this is a reality out in the world. What am I going to do about it? And I think that, a lot of people have either those kinds of direct experiences or at least the thought process of uncertainty, right? So it's not always necessarily like I got mugged, I need a gun, but it could be, wow, it's COVID and I'm hearing that the police aren't responding to many calls right now because they're all out sick or they're being taxed. So maybe I need to have a plan B. Or wow, there are people who are, protesting in the streets and it looks like it's getting a little out of hand. Or wow, they were going into a presidential election that I have no idea what the outcome of this is going to be. So I talk about insecurity and uncertainty, right? And the origins of gun culture 2.0 are really in the 1960s, in which there was a lot of uncertainty and insecurity, right? Rising crime rates in certain areas, but also political instability and just social change, right? When you feel like, holy crap, the world I'm moving into is not the world that I'm used to, that can create some of those feelings of sort of existential anxiety. And a lot of people put defensive gun owners down because they're like, oh, you're just freaking out, or you're just making up for your lost social status because you're a white man, or all of these other sociological explanations for why people get guns for defensive purposes. But I say, like, hey, I take existential insecurity seriously, that people respond to that in various different ways. Some people will have a midlife crisis. Some people will get a dog. Some people will get security cameras. Some people move into a gated community, and some people will buy a gun. And I think a lot of people, especially in 2020, did that. But going back, 45, 40 years, they were doing that also.
Well, and it's not, I can think of, I've had the fortune or misfortune as an elder millennial to live through a lot of unprecedented times to the point where I'm ready for some precedented times. Like, can we just do some, and then I was like, oh, let's just not do something unprecedented again. And then our version of doing the same thing again is this upcoming 2024 election. I'm like, no, we did that one. Let's
Yeah,
do, but
that's not what I meant.
that wasn't what I meant, guys. Golly. But I've seen one of the big ones that I remember is the Sandy Hook shooting and the response to, well, actually, I was in high school when Columbine happened. I remember that is a vivid emotional and cultural touchstone for me. And because of my background, I was raised in a conservative Christian family and my dad was a cop. It never occurred to me that the method used to carry out the killing was the problem. right? Because my, you know, I was raised to believe, and it's still a core belief of mine, that it's people that are the problem, right? And people are always going to be the root cause of the problem. Now, what influences people to become that sort of problem? That's, again, a discussion for psychologists and criminologists and people much smarter than me. But I remember my dad saying something along the lines of, he basically said that if he was outside of that school, nothing could have stopped him from going in, you know? And I remember that very vividly. And my thought was, yeah, that makes sense. It's your job. You're a police officer. You gotta go save the kids, right? And that was Columbine, and then Sandy Hook, and you know, the other ones that we've had since then. But I remember Sandy Hook specifically because I worked in the gun industry, and I had never seen a true, you know, run on the banks, quote unquote, like that before. And in the with a with and I look back on it now, and it feels silly because President Obama, for what, love him or hate him, was not that anti-gun in terms of policy. And this is an important distinction that I think that a lot of gun owners and people on my side can't make, is they cannot distinguish a person's rhetoric from their actual policies that they have enacted, right? Because President Obama's rhetoric was very anti-gun. His policies in office were not. Would he have been had he had a friendlier Congress? I don't know. That's, again, an argument for revisionist historians to have and not me. But looking at it at the time, watching people be extremely concerned about the possibility of the government taking that away and doing a run on, you know, AR-15 style rifles, ammunition and stuff like that, and then seeing that same thing happen again in COVID, I had a point and I completely lost it. It makes me wonder, it makes me wonder whether or not there are some threads. You know, we talked about how gun culture is not a monolith and there's different chunks of it, but it makes me wonder if there's threads that tie it all together like that, right? Because basically everybody I knew went out, I did during COVID, I went out and bought ammo. I still have a crate of Federal Flight Control buckshot in my gun closet that I have not... I have a shotgun that I shoot the shotgun. I have it's really good ammo, but I haven't shot it. What do I need 500 rounds of that for? To have. Awesome.
Right. Well, you know, I think, was it, Tam Keel who said, if a gun's disintegrated, on the shooting the 50th mm-hmm. round, that most guns would still exist. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I know, I'm not on the front lines in gun stores, but I know when I was crisscrossing the country, last summer, if I stopped in to see a friend who was working in a gun store, I'd say, like, you know, what are you seeing in terms of buying and then also selling? And they're saying, you know, a lot of people who bought guns in 2020 are bringing their brand new guns back, you know, to put on consignment or to sell back to the store, and, you know, very disappointed at how little value they get mm-hmm. for their brand new gun, right? They bought a gun. They brought it home and it just sat there. And it, you know, there are certain ways in which that's, you know, like it's a great time to buy a used RV or a Peloton bike or a weight
set. Oh my God, yes.
You know, because they're just brand new stuff flooding back onto the market now, you know, 3-4 years later. So that's probably, you know, some of this, the Sandy Hook, you know, the Columbine buying spree, you know, that some people will sort of react by buying a gun and then realize, why did I do that?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not using this thing. So,
would you say that I'm reminded of a conversation I had during COVID in a liquor store of all places with a guy who I must have been wearing like a branded shirt or something, and he asked me what I did for a living, and I talked about the firearms industry, and he asked me about advice to, you know, he was like he because it was the height of COVID, it was 2020, and he was like, I need a gun for personal protection. And in my head, I remember looking at him and thinking, you probably don't. You are an upper middle class man in a nice suburb of South Carolina. You know, the Black Panthers aren't coming down the street to burn your house down. And I remember, you know, I told him the thing that I tell basically everybody who I think is going to buy a gun and never train with it, which is actually to get a revolver because it's difficult to negligently discharge. But, you know, I remember that conversation very well, because that was, I think, the first time in my professional career where somebody told me that they wanted a gun for personal protection, and my first impulse was to tell them no. And to be like, there's better options out there for you. And do you think that, you know, you've had Chuck Haggard's pepper spray class, right? Or at the very least, you've been exposed to it.
Not directly, yeah. But people who have, you know, learned from him.
Have you been pepper sprayed?
I've never been pepper sprayed before, no. Do you think I should?
No, it's the worst. It's the worst thing ever. I would rather be tasered again than be pepper sprayed again. It's terrible. Because when the electricity from the taser shuts off, so does the pain. The pepper spray pain does not shut off when they're done pepper spraying you. It persists. It's awful. But I think one of the things, you know, that one of the assets, the resources that you provide and that I try to point people to is a measured perspective on maybe you don't need a gun, right?
Yeah. No, I think that you know, if you're in the gun community long enough, then you will hear people talking about, you know, these people should not have guns, or I don't go to public ranges because I don't feel safe at shooting at public ranges. And so, you know, I think by and large, gun owners are responsible and try to do the right thing, but there's always room for improvement. But it becomes hard, you know, to say anything negative, like certain people shouldn't have guns, or this person shouldn't have a gun, or we need to do better policing our ranges, because there's so much feeling of threat from the outside, right? If we ever expose any weaknesses, then people are just going to swoop right in and say, aha, see, we told you that gun owners are terrible people. So, you know, I try, you know, to say, like, look, if we don't do some good self-education and, you know, clean the culture up, then that's going to give life to people who want to regulate from the outside. But, you know, part of that cleaning up could be like saying, hey, look, you, not just even in a nasty way, but like, hey, look, you seem to be unwell right now. Like, maybe it's not a good time for you to have a gun, or you don't seem like very stable. Like, you probably shouldn't bring a gun into your household. Or like this advice, like, oh, you're in a situation of domestic violence and you're, you know, you should get a gun. I mean, that's could be a recipe for disaster, you know, that the just saying, oh, women who are abused need guns. I think that's just, you know, too simplistic.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me that people's personal lives and self-defense dilemmas are complex and often nuanced and can't be handled with 5-second soundbite advice? I'm shocked. Shocked, sir. Shocked, I say.
I'm preaching to the choir. I'm preaching to the choir.
You know, a little bit. And I hope that this, you know, gets out, that this will, you know, we're going to try to push this out to a wider audience. But one of the things that you said reminded me of something that, again, my wife has said about NRA, because so she has a negative perception of the NRA, and she, because they have gotten very heavily involved in more politics beyond just gun politics, and even some of the stuff they've done on gun politics has been a little cringe. And she said, you know, she said something to the extent of, you know, the NRA had the opportunity to be the adult voice in the room and instead chose to swing for cringe politics. And when she said that, I was like, oh, you're really right about that. And that kind of hurts. That gets me right there, because I do think she's right. And I think you know, as an example of policing our own, I do think that the community is trying to police the NRA right now. You know, if you had some great content around that from NRA annual meetings, and can you shed a little bit of light on, you know, what you observed and kind of what was going on?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't always go to the NRA meetings, but I went into 2019 and 2024, and in both years there was sort of a kind of members uprising to try to, you know, get the NRA back on track, to get Wayne LaPierre out, to get his cronies on the board out. And in 2019, it was pretty much a miserable failure. But in 2024, obviously, in the wake of, you know, the New York Attorney General's successful prosecution of NRA leadership, you know, this kind of members uprising that took place at the members meeting really was much more successful. You know, there was a proposal to move the NRA headquarters to Texas, and that was beaten back despite, you know, the strong support from the president of the NRA, Charles Cotton, and others. And you really see some board members starting to act independently, as a nonprofit board is supposed to. And so I think that it's not clear that the NRA has completely turned the corner, but there was some definite highlights. And one of the things, and again, I'm sorry, I'm in New Yorker, not YouTube
that is
short
A-OK.
mode. But talking to some board members who are extraordinarily conservative, talking Trump delegates, kind of conservative, but saying like, hey, there's a bunch of us out here that don't want the NRA to be a right-wing culture warrior organization, right? We want the NRA to focus on guns and gun rights and leave all of the other garbage behind. Not garbage, if those are your sincere political beliefs.
Yeah, but there's
leave all the other culture war stuff behind.
There are orgs who are here to fight, whatever right-wing culture war battle you want, whether or not I agree with them or I don't. There are other places for that to take place than from the NRA.
Yeah. And there was a recognition that, that's one of the directions that we're trying to go. Amanda Suffolk said we're trying to get 10 million NRA members. And I'm like, well, then you really got to drop, the non-gun politics angles, because, there's a lot of people who aren't going to be involved with you simply because of that. And I really, I think back to, this is going back to guns on TV, but NRA TV, was this mix of potentially amazing content, bringing in women gun owners, racial minority gun owners, Chris Chang, right? But at the same time, you have to, watch whoever it is smashing TVs and Dana Lash burning the New York Times and, hordes of immigrants coming across the border. And I'm like, if it was just leave that aside and just present this beautiful, diverse, interesting face of guns, that's a more likely to get you to 10 million than the other one.
Yeah, their NRA TV was that was an interesting experiment. And I could probably do a whole, 45 minute episode on that. But speaking of 45 minutes, in the interest of your time, I have two questions left, short form answers. The first is, the first may not be short form. But I have to ask you, because you are an academic and because I've seen it and I thought it was amazing and hilarious. Have you seen the study by University of Texas San Antonio about penis dissatisfaction and gun ownership in America?
Yes.
So for the record, this show is normally kind of lowbrow, and I had to get one penis reference into it, and this is the most academic way I could figure out how to do it. Any thoughts? Just, 10,000 foot view.
Yeah, I mean, it's a legitimate academic study. I know every author on that study, and I lamented the fact that they didn't invite me to be a co-author on the study, because nothing I would rather have than that on my resume.
Right? Look at this.
But, it's one of those things where, every question, merits a potential response. And so there is so much of this garbage out there about, guns and penises, that I'm glad that someone finally said, hey, look, there's some data that we have to answer this question. And, let's just stop talking about it now, because it's been scientifically proven to be false, although it's probably not going to stop happening.
No, of course not. No, it's too deeply entrenched in the cultural zeitgeist to ever really stop happening. I mean, I do a bit about it. One of my favorite jokes is like, hey, have you heard the one about, how guys with big trucks and big guns are compensating for tiny penises? And then my punchline is, I ride a Vespa and carry a 32. So, infer from that.
Draw your own conclusions.
Exactly. I think it's hysterical. So, all right, last question, and this is, the gear question. What is your EDC when you do carry? And I fully understand you are in an environment where you can't carry every day because you work in a university and there's like rules and shit about that. And I work in the gun industry. I'm in a room full of guns right now.
Yeah. I carry a Glock 48 with iron sights in a Dark Star Gear appendix inside the waistband holster.
Awesome.
Standard magazines, you know, I'm 10 plus one. I may die, you know, because I don't have a red dot or, you know, shield magazines, but,
I carry a
you know,
five shot
it's,
revolver a lot of the time. I think you'll be all right.
yeah. You know, and I've tried to carry bigger guns. It's like, this is very, very comfortable for me. It, I can wear it like all day long if I need to or want to. And so I feel fairly proficient with it, when I'm on the range, and I'm not opposed to checking out the dot lifestyle, especially as my eyes get worse and worse, but just haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah, that's the funny thing about dots. Gabe White said this in a class I took from him. He said the reason he doesn't use a red dot yet is because his eyes are still good with irons. And I go back and forth, but the reason that I am not dedicated to 100% dot life, guys, because my eyes still work pretty well with iron sights.
Well, that's
Professor,
also
oh, go ahead.
practically speaking, what does Gabe White need to do better, you know, in
Yeah.
terms of shooting? So.
Like Gabe White is he's good. I think he's set. But Professor, all right, so where can people go and get copies of Gun Curious?
Yeah, so all major retailers, including walking into your local bookstore and requesting it, they'll probably have to order it. It's not likely to be on the bookshelves, but if you go to guncurious.com, it'll give links to all of your options.
It is also on the website that used to be a bookstore, Amazon. I just looked. So it's there, and there's a Kindle edition as well. So for my e-reading friends, and I'll post a link to this as well in the show notes. And if people are interested in following you on social media or interacting with you, where can they do that?
I'm pretty active on Twitter slash X, as well as Instagram and Facebook. And I have a YouTube channel. If you go to lightoverheat.com, that's my short form. And by short form, I mean 6 to 8 minute videos, sometimes longer. You know, me commenting on all things guns, since my blog readership has fallen off so dramatically, I had to make the YouTube jump.
Yeah, blogs used to be the hotness and they're not anymore. Well, again, David, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me, to chat with our listeners. And for those guys who are out there listening to this, thank you for listening and watching. Please do share the show with your friends, family, you know, the kidnap people, put them in your car, make them listen to it while you drive to work. Don't do that. That's a crime. But it's not illegal to hire a day laborer outside of Home Depot and just drive around in them with the car while they listen to this. That is legal, technically. You just have to pay them for it. So, with that, that is it for this week's episode, guys. We will be back next week with an all new episode. Thank you again.